Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the show. We've got some really interesting guests for you this week, starting off with dietitian Kim Airy, who is here to discuss all things gluten. Is going on a gluten-free diet really the best choice for you? Kim gives you all the facts so you can make an educated decision about what is best for your body. We then chat with best-selling author Susan Rowan about the art of mingling so that you can be more comfortable and successful at corporate or social events. We have some great comedy from Gabriel Iglesias, and then we wrap things up with a remix from Nelly Furtado, Big Hoops.
Capture your need for sound.
Over the last while, it seems like the world is going crazy for gluten-free diets. No matter where you turn, in grocery stores or online, there are tons of promotional information or products claiming to be gluten-free. Even Kim Kardashian is now on the bandwagon, putting out a very sexy picture of herself with the caption, "Gluten-free is the way to be." To give us an idea what this gluten-free craze is all about and if it's something you should really consider doing for yourself is consulting dietitian Kim Airy, who has over 20 years experience in the field of nutrition. Kim, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for asking me to be here.
Now, Kim, for those of us who keep hearing the buzzword gluten, but don't really know what it encompasses, can you kind of explain it for us?
Yeah, basically, gluten is a protein that's found in some different grains. It's principally found in wheat, rye, barley, also in spelt and kamut. Sometimes can be in oats, but not because it's naturally in oats, but because the oats have been contaminated.
Now, there are people who suffer from conditions like celiac disease that must avoid gluten. Can you explain why that is?
Sure. Celiac disease is actually an autoimmune disorder where basically your body is, when it's exposed to gluten, it's going to actually cause a problem and you are going to have... In gluten disease, you have your intestine is what's affected, and you get malabsorption of nutrients, and you could end up with lactose intolerance. And when you have the gluten disorder or the gluten intolerance, you're really seeing the most severe form is celiac disease. So that's when it's going to really affect the gut. And that can be quite problematic. One of the reasons we're seeing that it's problematic, though, is because we're now realizing that only about 1 in 100 people who actually have this problem are diagnosed. So then once you're not diagnosed, that means you're not following a gluten-free diet. You're not eliminating the gluten. And that's probably the good news about celiac is that once you have the disease, although it's a big adjustment in the North American diet, once you eliminate gluten from your diet, you can actually be symptom-free.
Now, I have a couple of questions that have just popped into my mind with the information that you have given us. First of all, is celiac disease something that has been, I guess, around for a long time, or is this, you know, maybe on the increase because of our processed foods and such like that? I'm not sure if that's something you can answer or not, but that kind of popped into my head.
Well, actually, that was a good question. And it is something that is on the increase. It was, I guess we first started diagnosing it in the 1940s or 50s. It was starting to be diagnosed. And as we go along, what we're finding out that we're finding more and more of it. And for example, in a recent study, they actually are looking at, they looked at 10,000 people from 50 years ago and 10,000 people today, and they believe that the incidence of celiac has gone up by 4, or the incidence of elevated antibodies that would indicate you're intolerant to gluten has gone up 400%.
Wow. That's crazy.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and they can't find a reason why for that yet, or are they assuming that it's our food?
Well, you know, they're thinking all kinds of things. For example, in North America, because we like nice, fluffy bread, you know, we don't like... We don't like that, you know, stuff that weighs a lot and is dense. We like this nice fluffy stuff. They've actually put bread, the wheat, so that it's going to contain more and more gluten.
Okay.
To give us that oofy, nice bread.
Right. Okay.
That's what gives the bread the structure.
Okay. So potentially maybe in the past there could have been more of us with this, you know, tolerance issue, but because our diet is changing, this could be a reason for the increase.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay.
Our diet is changing because of, and also the amount, you know, people are eating a lot of grains, and they're, again, because it's so easy for us to have access to all this, we're eating just a lot of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, I mean, if you think back to, if I think back to my grandmother's time, which I always go back to, but, you know, for them to get, for my grandmother to get a cake, she had to actually make it, right?
Right.
She had to get the flour, she had to make it, she had to, it was really no commercial bakeries around. So you didn't necessarily eat cake every day. Well, I mean, now you can get cake, muffins, whatever, anywhere and just eat them all the time, right?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And I wanted to ask you as well, you mentioned that people are on the increase of eating more grain. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think one of the issues that I have when I see my clients is that the grain they eat is wheat.
Oh, okay. What should
so
they be eating?
There's lots of other great grains out there,
okay,
but we're eating mostly wheat. And we forget that. We say, oh, well, I'm having a lot of variety. I'm eating pasta, and I'm eating couscous, and I'm eating cracked wheat. And I'm saying, yeah, but it's all wheat.
Right. Okay.
So, okay, it's different forms of wheat,
mm-hmm,
but it's all wheat. Are you ever eating any flax? No. How often do you eat oats? Not often. You know, how often do you eat buckwheat? Oh, no, never touch that. And so I think that's part of the issue, whereas previously we would have had to have different types of grains in our diet.
You know, in the last couple of years, this is the only time that I've ever heard of the word gluten, to be honest with you. I can't even remember hearing this word in my life before maybe the last, I don't even know, maybe 12, 18 months. Maybe it's been a bit longer, don't even know. So is this, you know, gluten buzzword, is it because of people with the celiac disease that we're hearing more of it? Like, I'm just wondering why, you know, everyone, including all of these Hollywood stars, are now obsessed with gluten-free.
Well, I think one of the issues is that what we're learning about disease in general and gluten intolerance in particular is, as I mentioned before, celiac disease is like the strongest or most severe form of an intolerance to gluten, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can have gluten sensitivity, which means you're sensitive to it. And we don't really know. You have stuff that goes wrong with you, like maybe you have iron deficiency anemia, but we don't really know why. Or maybe you're always tired, but we don't really know why. Or maybe you get canker sores in your mouth, but we don't really know why. So there's all these things that, you know, are caused by inflammation. We don't really know why. And we're linking it back to this gluten sensitivity. So you're not sick, like with gluten, with celiac disease, where, you know, you have diarrhea and you have, like, you're really sick, you don't necessarily have a lot of symptoms that we would link back to gluten. And we certainly don't necessarily link it to the gut. You know, iron deficiency anemia, you don't necessarily link to the gut, right?
Okay. Okay.
We also see that we're also realizing now more and more that many different disorders that we have, heart disease, diabetes, having more inflammation in your body. And so if the inflammation gets turned on because you have a slight intolerance to something like wheat, then for sure that can make those things worse. So, for example, we have some studies that show that people with rheumatoid arthritis, if some of them may be strongly affected by reducing the amount or eliminating the amount of gluten in their diet. One of the studies showed that about 20-25% of the people who went on a vegan gluten-free diet actually there had a really significant improvement in their rheumatoid arthritis. Now, I understand it's 25%. It's not 75%, but for some people it might be worth a try.
Joining us on the show is consulting dietitian Kim Airy. Make sure to check out her website, kimairy.com. Now, Kim, I guess back to the sort of Hollywood A-list people that are on this bandwagon, and I think a lot of people take from them, that's why I'm using them as the example. It mm-hmm. seems that, you know, for example, Kim Kardashian saying that gluten-free is the way to be. Now, is this, you know, this big weight loss thing for them, associating the non-gluten to losing weight?
Well, I think the non-gluten to losing weight is often because my experience with my clients is they're really good at taking things out of their diet, but they're not really good at replacing them, okay? So one of the biggest issues is if you take out all wheat, and that's your principal source of grains, and you don't, like, bother to learn how to cook quinoa, and you don't bother to learn how to use buckwheat, and you never go near wild rice because that's really too hard to manage, and just kind of leave everything out, well, yeah, if you leave out all the grains, you're going to lose weight because you're going to have reduced your caloric intake significantly. Because we know that if you have an intolerance, that would likely to increase the amount of inflammation that's in your body. And we know that people who are overweight also have higher levels of C-reactive protein, which means they have more inflammatory, they have something causing inflammation in their body. Could that play a role in raising the inflammation, and that play a role in the obesity? We don't really have a good cause and effect on that. So right now, I would say the biggest reason that people would see they lose weight when they go on gluten-free really has a lot to do with the fact that they cut a lot of stuff out.
And is it truly realistic that people, you know, who for non-health reasons, you know, will stick to an absolutely gluten-free diet? Because I feel like, you know, there's a bunch of people that might start off saying, I'm going gluten-free, but then because it's really not a health issue for them, like they don't have celiac, so it's not life or death, but I know that it can be very uncomfortable, obviously, for a celiac person to be taking the gluten. I feel like a person who's not really affected health-wise by it, if they get on the bandwagon, I feel they might start waffling back and forth. And to me, that must be not good for your body either.
Well, I think the biggest danger in any of this is really is that if you don't get, because there are blood tests that can tell you if the antibodies to the gluten are high and if you have a certain amount of inflammatory markers in your system. And if you're wanting going on and off and on and off and on and off, certainly that will give you a false reaction to your test. If you're not eating gluten, you go get the test, it's going to be a false negative, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because you've got of course the antibodies are going to be low. You didn't have any gluten.
That makes sense.
So just like with any other allergy or sensitivity, how we test it is we give you some and then we see what happens, right? So if you're going off, then you go for a test, it's going to say, no, you don't have anything. You're going to get all, so, okay, I don't have any gluten. I'm going to start eating gluten. You're going to start feeling lousy again. And that from that point of view, it's not really great because then it gets in the way of actually finding out if there's an issue or not. The other concern I would have for people who are going on and off and on and off is, of course, that means they're not really learning about those new varieties of food they can add in their diet, and they're not really balancing their diet. That probably means they're taking a whole bunch of stuff out, and then they're not adding stuff in. They say, oh my God, I can't stand not eating pasta anymore, or oh my God, I can't do this anymore. And, you know, next thing you know, they go back to it. And so from that point of view, I think it's important that, you know, you integrate these new products into your diet, and that's going to be what's going to help you to stay gluten-free if that's truly a choice you want to make.
And what are your thoughts on all these products now that claim to be gluten-free? Because you must really need to be, you know, reading the labels, because I'm assuming that if they've taken out the gluten, they may have replaced it with some other processed ingredients that, you know, may not be too healthy either.
Well, I think the one thing we have to look at with the gluten-free products, it's not that they take out the gluten because they can't take it out of the wheat, right?
Okay.
So what they're going to do is they're going to replace the wheat with, let's say, in pasta with quinoa or rice flour or a combination of different flours. And so then what we need to do is we need to see, because we know, for example, the wheat that's been used to make a lot of products has been fortified, whereas these other flours are not necessarily fortified. So you might be missing out on nutrients. The other thing, again, that I worry about is people are going around looking for these gluten-free products, and a lot of them are really highly refined. So again, they're not taking the time to look for how do I cook my buckwheat, or how do I eat teff, or how do I add quinoa to my diet, or millet, or any of these really great grains. And what they're doing is they're saying, oh, I like cookies, I'll just go buy, you know, the gluten-free cookies. But, you know, cookies aren't really healthy anyways.
Right.
So now you made them with gluten-free flour and lots of sugar. So that's not really great either.
So you really need to be aware of what's going on.
You need to be aware. You need to also remember that gluten is used in a lot of products. So it's not so much, it's not only about, okay, I'm not going to have wheat, but it's about doing things like checking your soup label, because a lot of times they'll use texturized vegetable protein, which is often gluten, in making that, or they'll use other products that have contained gluten. It's also often in meat analogs, you know, the veggie pâtés and stuff. It might be in there, veggie burgers, that kind of thing. So that's where you have to really read the labels. The gluten-free products, I would be very confident that they don't contain gluten. I'm just not sure all of them are, you know, highly nutritious. What I'm really more concerned about is, where is it hiding in cold cuts and soups and whatever?
Now, you mentioned before taking out gluten and you might be cutting out important nutrients. What types of nutrients could you be cutting that would be very bad? Like what, fiber, zinc? I don't know.
Fiber is probably the one that is the most important, because that's the one that we really, you know, usually we associate fiber with wheat bran, that kind of thing. So that's really the one that is the most important. After that, we know that celiac disease is associated with different nutrient deficiencies, not enough calcium, not enough iron, not enough folic acid, magnesium, zinc. And what we're not sure of, is it because when you have gluten-free diet, are you not consuming enough? Or is it because if you have a gluten intolerance and your intestine is affected, you're not absorbing those nutrients properly? Again, if we go back to, if you have whole grains, if you're going to have, you know, various whole grains, you will get the fiber that you need, and you have to make more effort to balance your diet to make sure you get the folic acid you need and the zinc and the other B vitamins that would normally be added to your grains. They're added to wheat because they were there originally. They were taken out in the milling process, and we add them back to make the new refined wheat more nutritious. But often those nutrients are in the whole grains you would be eating, so it's not a stretch to say that you could find them easily.
Joining us on the show is consulting dietitian Kim Airy. Check out her website, kimairy.com. Kim, can you explain to me what gluten sensitivity is? Because I was reading a bunch of articles preparing for our chat today, and that sort of kept coming up, but I wasn't sure what that means. So it's like not full-on celiac, I'm assuming, to some degree.
Exactly. Basically, what that would say is, basically, what we're looking at now is we're kind of trying to start redefining this. And we're saying, look, if the levels of antibodies are there, if those antibodies are there, if they're elevated, even if you have no symptoms and we look at your intestine and we take a biopsy, there could be nothing there. But if those antibodies are high, then that means you're sensitive and you should be on a gluten-free diet. Okay, so you don't have full-blown celiac. It hasn't gotten there yet. Maybe the reason people with celiac have this full-blown disease is because they've had intolerance for a long time and it's progressed. We don't really know that. What we do know is now we're kind of looking at different kind of diagnosis of gluten sensitivity and then celiac, which is something which is where you do the biopsy of the intestine and you see that the intestine is being affected. And there's also something that's a little kind of bit different where we're saying there's gluten celiac disease, but it's not really diagnosed because, yes, the antibody levels are really high, but the gut has not been affected yet. So it seems like we've almost got like three phases now that we're looking at.
And in your opinion, apart from people who really need to be on this gluten-free diet, like the celiac people, is this really a solid choice for, you know, other people to be making regarding their dietary needs? Because, I don't know, it bothers me.
Yeah, and I can appreciate that. And I guess what I try and tell people is, look, we know that inflammation, we're really starting to see that inflammation seems to be at the root cause of many different diseases like diabetes and heart disease and different types of arthritis or autoimmune disorders. So if you have any of the kind of symptoms we're talking about, if you have eczema, if you have some kind of arthritis pain, if you have any kind of inflammation, maybe it's worth giving it a try. Certainly, if you want to give it a try, that's fine. Another thing that you might want to do if you have those things is say, I'm not going to try this gluten-free diet. But what I am going to do is I'm going to ask my doctor to get me these tests so I can see if my antibodies are high or not. And if my antibodies are high, then I have to do something. If my antibodies are normal, then maybe I don't. Everybody could certainly do with starting to make more variety. You know, dietitians are a pain in the neck, right? We always talk about variety. And just like we ask you to make a lot of colors on your plate, we need to come up with some catchy phrase to get you to eat a lot of different grains and not solely rely on wheat.
And do you think that these gluten-free diets are here to stay or are just a fad?
No, I think that it's here to stay. I think that as we get better at diagnosing the sensitivities, and as we get better at doing more individualized medicine and finding out what exactly makes you, Kelly, tick, or what exactly makes me, Kim, tick, we might actually see that we're able to better zero in on these problems and know exactly what we need to do. And so, yes, I think they're here to stay.
And something I've noticed about just people in general is the fact that, you know, we're so good about taking care of other people and we often don't take care of ourselves, especially when it comes to, I think, our nutrition. Can you just give us maybe a few examples of what other choices are apart from wheat? Because, again, I think people, you know, oftentimes won't take the time to go research about other options that they could be taking in, you know, to maybe lessen their gluten intake anyway, just on a healthy level.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. There are a number of different grains that you could try. You could try aramath. You could try buckwheat. I mean, buckwheat is amazing. And buckwheat, you can eat it in different forms. You can use it as a flour. I think we're all in Quebec. We've all heard of crepe or galette de sarrasin, which is buckwheat crepes. I don't think we're as familiar with using buckwheat groats, where we could replace rice with buckwheat. Buckwheat is actually a plant that resembles, it's from the rhubarb family. So it's not even really a grain, it's actually a fruit, but we can cook it up like a grain. You can have millet. You can actually have oats. There are some issues you can. There are some oats that are certified as being non-contaminated. Brown rice, quinoa. Quinoa is great. I mean, you can use it to do a lot of things. You can make a salad with it. You can use it to make tabbouleh. You can make it, I make hamburgers with it all the time. I mean, it's really amazing. Sorghum is another great grain you can use. Teff is also wonderful. Wild rice, you know, we can use that. So I think there's just many, many, many grains that we can use. We're just not familiar with them, and we have to learn how to use them. Also, when we're talking about flours to use in baking and cooking, again, it's now possible to get flours made of different grains, so it's easy to get rice flour, it's easy to get potato flour, but it's also easy to get chickpea flour and lentil flour, and flours made with the different pulses, flours made from corn, from soy. So again, I think when we look at this, it's easy for us to find ways to make products that don't necessarily contain wheat and yet are very nutritious.
Fantastic. Well, Kim, I really appreciate your time and thank you so much for all this information. I think it's really important, again, as people are bombarded constantly with, you know, this gluten-free diets and stuff and that being in our face. So thank you so much for this.
You're very welcome.
That's consulting dietitian Kim Airy. Again, make sure you go to her website, kimairy.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
You know what was crazy, bro? When I was in Iraq, they wanted me to go to different bases, but they wouldn't let me go because they have to provide you with a helmet and a bulletproof vest. And apparently, the military does not have a big and tall. They put that 75-pound vest on me. It looked like a bulletproof bib. Like, if somebody shoots my snack, I'm okay, you know? I'll stop right here. I'm like, oh, my God. No. Oh, man. We flew into Korea. That threw me off a little bit, too. We go to check into the hotel, and it was kind of scary for me because the phone had a big sticker on it that said, "Do not discuss classified information. Someone is always listening." That's freaky because I'm calling my girl back home, right?
Hello?
Hey, baby. Oh, my God, where are you? I can't tell you. Oh, my God, I'm so worried. Don't worry, baby. Everything's cool. Oh, my God, I miss you so much. Where are you? I can't tell you. So I'm trying to give her clues, right? Germany? What? I'm kidding. Oh, thank God. I wish you were home. Why? If you were home right now, we'd be in the room. Really? What else?
and we'd be laying on the bed.
Check you out. All of a sudden, I heard a voice that said,
"What else would you do?" Sorry, proceed.
Lockers over there.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
In this day and age, if you want to get ahead in your career and even enjoy a more interesting social scene, it's very important that you know how to work a room, meet people, and build relationships. For many of us, this is a very hard thing to do because we identify ourselves as a shy person and not capable of being captain personality. Well, to help us get over this barrier and break free is keynote speaker, best-selling author Susan Rowan, who is also known as the Mingling Maven. Susan, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, Kelly, I'm so delighted to be with you.
So, Susan, I wanted to start off by saying I think so many of us think we are alone when it comes to being shy and uncomfortable in corporate or social settings, but I'm assuming that's not necessarily true.
Oh, it's not even close to being true. And that was what I based a lot of my work on my book about, which is the statistics from the Stanford Shyness Clinic in the 1980s. 80% of us self-identify as shy. Then you go and take a look at it like 13 years later, and it went up to 93% of adults identify as shy. Well, what caused that increase? Technology. So really, if you walk into a room and you're going, "Oh, I'm not that comfortable," you are normal. You're among the majority.
Wow. Well, that's good to know, because I think a lot of us feel like we are, you know, a fish out of water. And I wanted to ask you, in your mind, just how important is the ability to sort of navigate a room and meet and converse with new people or someone that may be able to help you advance your career? That has to be a very intimidating thing to sort of take on.
It's very intimidating. It's very daunting. First of all, you're not comfortable walking in a room. You don't know who's there, what to say, etc. But it is so crucial. I mean, in all the programs I've done for leadership for various Fortune 120 companies, the reality is the ability to walk into a room and not only make yourself comfortable, but I'm going to give our listeners another way to look at it. Walk in the room with the goal of making other people comfortable with you. That takes the onus off yourself. And when other people are comfortable, they open up, then you're more comfortable. The next thing you know, you're in a conversation. But it's so crucial. It's not just about having leaders have this skill. We all want this skill. Nobody wants to face an event or gathering and not feel adept, comfortable, effective, etc.
What's the first step for someone to start, you know, sort of breaking free of feeling inept at socializing, whether it is at work, you know, or in a social setting? Is it like a mental thing?
Well, part of it is an attitude, but the other part is, and this is, I'm a former teacher, it's about being prepared. So what I like to say to people and my audience is, be prepared before you go anywhere. Think of who might be at that event and what you have in common with them. Now with the advent of Google and searching and Facebook and events all online, we would have a much better idea of the theme, who might be there. We might even get to see an Evite list. If you take the time to think, oh my goodness, this is who might be there. This is what professions they're in. What do I have in common with them? You'll be more prepared. But the second thing I tell people is, don't go anywhere without preparing your own self-introduction. Most likely, Kelly, there's nobody to introduce you at the door to people. So if you know how to introduce yourself, and that would be connected to that specific event because it'll change at different events, you will be more comfortable and confident.
Is it important as well, Susan, to, you know, you mentioned about doing your research and knowing who's going to be there. Is it also important to know the tone of the event? Because, you know, I've been to a lot of corporate settings where, you know, it might not be the place to be discussing work, even though it's a workplace function.
Oh, absolutely. You know, what I say is, if you have a beverage in one hand and an hors d'oeuvre in another, this is not going to be the time to get anyone to sign on the dotted line to buy your services, to give you a job. This is about starting the conversation, developing the rapport, upon which, with further communication, relationships and trust are built. So you have to get an inkling. I mean, if it's a party-ish, even though sponsored by a business, this is not the time. This is just the time to do the meeting, the mingling, the connecting, the making people comfortable with you so that you're memorable to them.
You know, a few moments ago, you mentioned how important it is to sort of have a personal introduction because, like you said, it's not like you're the Queen of England and you're going to be introduced to everyone as you stroll into the room. What is your key points, I guess, to have an introduction ready for yourself so you do feel confident walking in, meeting new people?
Well, this, unlike what a lot of people say about having an elevator pitch, you're not in an elevator. This is not the time to have 30 seconds to a minute about yourself. Key factors in your self-introduction, it's 7 to 9 seconds. It's a pleasantry. It's not a pitch. The second point is you key it to the specific event. How you introduce yourself at your own company event would be very different than you might introduce yourself at a charity fundraiser sponsored by a client or a friend's company. And the third part is, I got this from my friend Patricia Fripp, who's an executive speech coach. Instead of giving your title, that can be so boring, give the benefit of what you do. If you're in real estate, it might be, oh, and I put roofs over people's heads. Give some people a benefit of what you do, said in a very lighthearted way, so that you're giving people enough information to ask the first question. They think they've started the conversation. They're more comfortable, and then you're really in a conversation.
Joining us on the show is keynote speaker, best-selling author, Susan Rowan. Make sure to check her out. Her website, very simple, www.susanrowan.com. Susan, when you march into these corporate events or social settings, what types of topics, should you be armed with? Because, as you mentioned, if there's a drink in one hand and, some food in the other, you don't want to start talking maybe necessarily about politics right off the hop.
Right. Politics would be something you ease into. And if you do want to talk because something very important happened globally, you can put it in the middle of a sentence in a prepositional phrase. That way you're signaling a person. If they don't pick it up, you move on to the next thing. But really, you do talk about small talk items, the event, the venue, the sponsor, the food. You start with little things. Where are you from? Are you originally from here? Many people have moved from place to place, so you might find out that you're at a place in Montreal, but someone might have been born in Singapore. You just don't know. So if you start with that kind of what we call small talk, it invariably leads to the big talk. But that's how we learn about people, and it's also how we learn those points of connections that we have in common.
Susan, how do you avoid coming off as being fake or, uncomfortably conversing? Because I feel like that is a concern for so many of us who maybe deem ourselves as shy. And, you are trying to schmooze, for lack of a better term, and make a good impression. I think a lot of people are always fearful of maybe being too much when talking to the bosses or people that could help them.
Well, I think when we're talking to bosses or people that could help us, we want to be aware that there is, there's still the boss, et cetera. But if you're comfortable in your own skin, and again, if you turn to make that person comfortable, then that works better for you. A lot of people assume that the boss or the people that can help them are comfortable. No, 90% of them are shy too. So if you are just polite, appropriate, conversant, this is not the time to ask them certainly for a raise or for a new position. But if you miss the opportunity of talking to that person in a more casual situation, believe me, you'll regret it. So it's important to say something rather than nothing.
And do you, when you're speaking with them again, with casual topics, is it very important for you to become the listener in a way? Because, you often hear that people like to talk about themselves.
Well, I think there's a balance. There are people who seem like they never listen, but there are people who went to that school of thought of all we have to do is ask questions and let people talk about themselves. I would caution against that. When you do that, people will invariably, they'll talk, but they could be resentful because it sounds like you're prying, you're interrogating. So it's a balance. It's asking questions, it's sharing information, it's making observations. But the bottom line is if you don't listen to what people are saying, you won't know what to talk about because often someone will make a comment and that's the direction you should pick up because that's what they're interested in. So listening is crucial. But if all you do is listen and you don't contribute, you're not in a conversation.
Now, something I wanted to ask you about with regards to me, I'm going to use myself as an example. Last week, I actually had to go to an industry event with regards to a CD launch, and I was happy to be there, but I didn't know anyone except for my friend that I had brought with me. Now, I kind of use that as an example because I know that I am not necessarily comfortable just launching into conversation with people, even though I am a radio announcer. So I found it interesting in the fact that I didn't even really know where to start, because a bunch of these people I knew were probably people I should talk to, just, you know, to get to know, especially around my city, that I might cross paths with them again, especially in the industry that I'm in. I didn't know how to launch into it because I didn't know really anyone except for the people that invited me.
Well, you know what? And this is the exact situation so many of us find that we're in. So I'm glad you mentioned it. What you do is you know who you are, you know why you're invited. The easiest thing to do is to go over to someone standing alone. And I'll tell you why. Believe me, they feel uncomfortable if they're standing alone. I don't know if the event has name tags, but sometimes the name tags will give you some hint. Just say, oh, I see you're here. How did you get invited? Is this your first time at this particular venue? I mean, it starts with little small talk. Go over to the person alone. Generally, they'll be so happy that you came over to them, they will feel welcomed. The second thing is, sometimes we walk into an event and we see people in groups and we're thinking, oh my gosh, everyone's already talking to each other. Go over to a group that has four or five people. Sometimes when we go to an event with someone, we only talk to that person. And you know what? Honestly, you really did need, like you said, to meet some of the people in your industry. It takes, I guess, a lot of courage. Take a deep breath and go over to that group that has four or five people that look like they're having a good time. You can stand in the periphery, and when someone acknowledges you, you can say something agreeable. Step into the conversation. But if you go to an event and you only talk to the person you came with or stand alone, why even go? And that's why I want people to be comfortable, know how to work a room, know how to meet people, and know how to exit conversations, because that's equally important.
I want to speak to you about that in a second as well. And I'm glad that we were talking about this specific example, because I felt like an island unto myself at this event, because there was, like, I would say maybe 40, 50 people at the event. So it wasn't that big. And there was little pockets of groups, you know, around this bar area, this lounge that we were at. And I felt like it was the Great Wall of China. Like, I didn't know how to, like, again, get in there. I mean, eventually I did sort of end up seeing someone I knew, and then she introduced me to someone else. So it started that way, and things sort of worked out well. And actually, to be honest with you, the friend that I brought with me, I brought her with me on purpose because she is great in social settings. And I knew that even though she wasn't even in my industry, she would start talking to someone and probably it would help me out. And sure enough, that's what happened. But I know I can't be relying on friends like that. It was like an island unto myself, and it was hard to get there and open things up.
It is hard. And what you just did was really smart. And to all our listeners, if you have a friend that is good at doing this, by all means, bring a friend. But the other part is, sometimes we aren't invited with someone else. We're invited alone. So that's why we really have to prepare, have our self-introduction, read the paper, listen to radio, know what's going on in your own community. I mean, people do talk about movies and books and celebrities and sports. And how about this? You know what else? We talk about food. So if they're serving food, there is someone that's going to talk to you about the chocolate cake at the dessert table or the sushi at the special appetizers. So really, sometimes the talk is about things going on in the venue. But if we don't go into a room thinking we're going to meet some potentially interesting people, and that goes back to what you first said about attitude. This one is go everywhere thinking, oh, wow, who am I going to get to meet? Instead of, oh, my God, who am I going to have to meet?
That's a good thing to have in your head. I think that's perfect, because that's how I actually felt when I went to this event. It was like, I knew I needed to go. I knew it was going to be beneficial for me to go. But I was like very trepidatious about it, because I am not good when I don't know people and I have to do it that way. So go on. Sorry.
Bringing a wingman or a wingwoman is brilliant. In fact, I remember I had a friend who was single when I was married. She brought me to an event so I could help introduce her to single men. It really worked very well.
That's fantastic. And Susan, you were talking, you know, about exiting a conversation. How do you do that?
Well, you know, there's three ways to exit. If you've had a great conversation with someone, but you know, you can observe they're kind of ready to meet other people in the room. We don't ever want to be the person that hogs people's time. So what you do is you observe them, but what you say to them is, oh, you interrupt yourself, not them, and say, you know, it was so nice to talk to you about, and in one little phrase, summarize what you're talking about so they know you were listening. And then if it's time to exchange cards, you may ask, oh, do you have a card? And if you promise to send them something, an article or whatever, of course, we have to do that. If they don't ask for your card, it's very fair to say with the most polite, oh, may I offer you one of mine? And then what you do, you must walk a quarter of the room away from the person. If you stand in the same space, it looks like you turned your back. So that's one way, but that's when you've had a really nice conversation. Now, I have a friend who, oh, she is so charming. I love being with her. I watched her do this. Brilliant. She'll talk to someone for a couple of minutes, and she says, oh, I'm having such a good time talking to you. You know, I could really monopolize all your time, but I know that you need to meet other people, and other people want to meet you.
Wow.
And you know what? I haven't been able to pull that off yet, but I thought, it's fun, it's kind, it's true, because she's the kind of person who couldn't monopolize you, but she's so sensitive to the fact that people come there to meet more than one person. And she makes people feel good as she's exiting them. And if she's what she's great at is if she says that there'll be any follow-up, immediately she does what she says she's going to do the next day. But that's one way. Another thing is if you're talking to someone, and let's just say, Kelly, they're not interesting to talk to. They seem so distracted, almost to the point of being cold. It could be that there's nothing to do with you, that they just maybe got some bad news from the family, from career, etc., and they're distracted. So we must never be rude, no matter how it appears that they are rude. You still put out your hand, and instead of saying, it was wonderful talking to you, big smile on your face, you say, oh, I hope you enjoy the rest of the event. Because the next time you see them, everything could be fine. And if you were equally rude to them, they will only remember your rudeness, not how they were. But you still walk a quarter of the room away, over to another person standing alone or a group with three or four people.
And you mentioned, you know, about the business cards and the exchange of that. Can you please explain this? Because I think this is a very key element when you're, you know, doing the schmooze.
Well, and by the way, schmooze is exactly what we call it. Let me define it. Schmooze is easygoing, connected, friendly conversation. There's some people that think it's about getting what you want. That isn't it. It's that easygoing conversation. And when you want someone's business card, I always think the language of politeness and manners is the best. Oh, do you have a card? Or you could say, may I have one of your cards? And that way, who's going to say to you, actually, I'm going to give them to other people and not to you? I mean, people are generally going to give you a card. And this is not the time, and because how we do it in the West is different than the East, this is not the time to put the card in your pocket. You look at the card and give it the honor by looking at the name of the company, and make a comment before you put it in a card case, etc. And, you know, may I offer you one of mine? It's an exchange. It differs in different countries. The customs differ. But always there's a custom, and it's always about being polite. And as long as we make sure that we honor people's cards and look at them, because they'll provide us information for conversation as well, that really helps us. And guess what? It helps us remember the person we talk to.
Okay, fantastic. Joining us on the show is keynote speaker and best-selling author Susan Rowan. Check her out on her website, susanrowan.com. Now, what are your big no-nos to stay away from when trying to make your mark at a workplace function?
First of all, the bar. No, you can have the requisite one drink. At a workplace function, I don't care if it's a no-host bar, this is not the place to show how well you can hold your liquor, because most likely you can't. So I know I hate to be a killjoy, but be very careful about giving the impression that you're good at drinking at a business event. Also, in terms of food, I'd stay away from anything with garlic. It does impact conversations. The other thing to do is this is not the time to reveal too much about yourself that is personal. You can reveal a little bit here, ask a little bit there, but remember, it's still about business. And even though it might look social, with a band and with food and with a theme and entertainment, if it's sponsored by any kind of business group, it's business. And remember, it can impact your career.
And something as well you mentioned about the drinking, You know, I've been at events, especially in the industry that I'm in, the entertainment industry. You see all kinds of different people, all kinds of, you know, eccentricities, I guess, if you will. I've witnessed my fair share of people who are drunk at functions, and it seems to stick with them.
I would, you know, usually someone that is inebriated will say or do something completely inappropriate. When someone is like that, the best thing to do is very nicely and politely exit the conversation, because it's not going to go in the place that you expect it to go. And for those of us, I know there are people listening to this thinking I am a killjoy, but really, business is about business, and the impressions we make in social situations often stick. I wouldn't stick around talking to the inebriated person. That could just be dicey.
Okay. And what are your top tips, Susan, to keep in your mind when you are at, you know, a workplace function, whether it is like a black tie dinner, you know, you're going to whatever the bank function of the year, or you are at the company barbecue?
One is, remember, there's different behaviors and different dress codes for different kinds of events. This is not the time to mix up what you should be wearing. And at a formal event, our behaviors are a little more formal. At a barbecue, it's more casual. But never dress inappropriately. Never dress wearing the wrong thing. And I always encourage this. Both men and women have dressed inappropriately, but anything sponsored by business is not the time to wear anything for women that is revealing, too tight, too short, etc. I have heard from men in business who have talked about the inappropriate dress of the women in their office, etc. We want to make sure that this is about business. Still be charming, attractive, well-dressed, well-coiffed, and that goes for men too. But we really have to remember, if it's about business, to be a little more professional.
And how do you avoid, you know, because I really want this to sort of stick, you know, in people's minds, how do you avoid being the obviously awkward and shy person that ends up, you know, hanging out near the bar or sitting alone at the table closest to the exit? Because I think this is really important for people who do want to advance, whether it's professionally or personally at social gatherings.
Well, you have to make a commitment that this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to walk in. I'm going to go over to people standing alone. I'm going to suss out these groups of people that look like they're having a good time. Don't sit down at an event unless it's a sit-down dinner. I've seen it, you're right. People sit down and they sit by themselves. Make it easy for people to come over to you. Stay standing. I've seen this at cocktail events where they put tables down. No one's coming over to you when you're sitting down. Mingling is very often the movement through a room. We can't do this when we're seated. But you have to make a commitment that says, tonight I'm going to talk to at least 3 new people and follow through. You know what, really, Kelly, knowing that 90% of us are shy, people will be so happy if you come over to them. In all my seminars, when I ask people, how does it feel when a stranger approaches you, they will say, you know, it actually made me feel welcome. It made me feel that you picked me out of the crowd. So it's really a compliment when you go over to someone. You can even go over and say, you know, you really look so open, and I'm a little uncomfortable and shy, so I want to thank you for having a smile on your face. And by the way, there's a second part to approaching, and that is be approachable. Wherever you go, make sure you're wearing a smile and that you make eye contact with people so you are making it easy for them to talk to you.
And Susan, you know, at the end of the evening when you're driving home, should you end up having like a postmortem, you know, with yourself to go over in your head how you did at the event so that you can maybe mentally take notes of what to do and what not to do next time around?
I think that's a good idea. Think, oh my gosh, I wish I had said this. And do actually write it down, what I wish I had done. But don't just beat yourself up. It's take the time to think about what I wish I would have done, what I could have done better, what I did that I am so proud of. Always include that category, because if we don't say what we think we did well, we won't really know what we want to continue to embrace and do more of. Give yourself some pats on the back. We're so good at beating ourselves up. Let's try giving ourselves a compliment. The other thing is what I did and said that I don't think I should have, Make a mental note of that. You most likely won't do that again. But really say the good things that you did well, because those are what you're going to really do more of the next time.
Fantastic. Susan, where do people get copies of your book? Because I know that this is so important and that your books are going to help people.
Well, How to Work a Room and my whole little family of books are available anywhere at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. And I'm going to make a pitch, whatever community you live in, country you live in, you have local bookstores, try to support your local bookstores. They can always order the book for you. I've been very blessed to have bookstores be supportive of my career since How to Work a Room came out, so I want to in turn support them.
Susan, you have been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'd love to, and I'm happy to come to any country, any city, and talk about the subject.
Excellent. Thank you. That is keynote speaker and best-selling author Susan Rowan. Make sure to check her out, SusanRowan.com.
Bring on the remix.
Nelly Furtado with Big Hoops, the Wide Boys radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. Can't believe another show has come and gone. A big thank you to my guests, Kim Airy and Susan Rowan. They were fantastic to have on the show. I really appreciated their time. And I want to remind you that next week we have an awesome interview with Dr. Christopher Vaughn about kids sustaining concussions in contact sports and what you need to know as parents to keep them as safe and as healthy as possible. Now, before I go, here's your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Judy Adler. Champions know there are no shortcuts to the top. They climb the mountain one step at a time. They have no use for helicopters. Have a great week. Any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I'll chat soon.